Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of Brian Alvarez After Dark. In a couple of moments, we're going to be joined by Carl Stern, going over all of the news. You can follow along at our website, brianalvarez.com, a listing of all the latest news stories that Carl and I are going to be talking about today. Also, information up there for those of you listening to the show for the first time. Got a list of the past shows we have done, a list of upcoming guests. We've actually got several guests lined up in the next couple of weeks, so make sure you head up there and check that out. We're going to be adding new guests as time goes on, and a big show today. We're going to be joined by Steve Sims. Most of you probably know from his work covering Lucha Libre. We're not going to be covering any of that today. We're going to be talking about Ray Kurzweil and his book, The Singularity Is Near. Those of you that don't know what that's about, you can head up to the website. We've got a couple of articles up there. We're going to be talking to a couple of them with Carl Stern, basically talking about the point when computers reach the level of capacity that they are indistinguishable from human intelligence, coming up perhaps in just a matter of decades. We're going to be talking about that with Steve Sims. Should be a fun show. I want to thank everybody for the feedback to last week's program. You can always send emails to brianalvarezafterdark@gmail.com. That's brianalvarezafterdark@gmail.com. You think you'd be a good guest on the program. If you've got news articles, just want to send feedback or thoughts, brianalvarezafterdark@gmail.com is the place to go. And the website, brianalvarez.com, for more news stories and information on these sorts of topics. So let's not waste any time. We're going to get Carl Stern here on the line, get talking about the news, and then later on, Steve Sims talking the singularity and transhumanism. You're listening to Brian Alvarez After Dark here at brianalvarez.com. We are back here on the program. We are joined by Carl Stern to talk the latest news, always available at brianalvarez.com. Carl, how are you doing today?
Brian, I'm doing fantastic. I'm loving brianalvarez.com. And to remind everybody out there of my website, carlstern.com, bookmark them both and visit them often.
I wanted to start with the story about the IBM, the Jeopardy game, which is coming up in early February. It's going to be taking place over 3 days. And two of the greats in the history of Jeopardy, I believe the man who has won the most amount of money and the man on the longest win streak, are both going to be facing off against a computer. And I guess they've already done a dry run for the press, and the computer beat them. The computer's name is Watson. It's going to be taking on two of the Jeopardy participants. The article is up on brianalvarez.com right now. But what are your thoughts on this story?
Well, this is a tremendous story to ask me about today, Brian, because I'm in a very much a tech geeky mood, because just last night I joined the New Century by purchasing an iPad.
And so really?
I've been very much in the tech mix. And there are several tech stories out there, including this one of Watson the supercomputer. It's computers have a fairly dark history of defeating humans in various tournaments. Of course, there's the famous story of Garry Kasparov being defeated by Deep Blue, one of the famous chess champions. And now, apparently, Watson is here to gain artificial intelligence and take over the world by defeating Jeopardy champions. And just playing around with my new iPad today, it is just amazing how far technology has come in the last, gosh, even 5 years or so. When you think back to some of the early, even back when I was in high school and we were learning how to draw, you know, very rudimentary barns and animating birds with Apple II computers, writing them in code. It's just, in the last 20 years, has become frighteningly powerful, because the computer industry has, and with the processors getting smaller and smaller and faster and faster. And, it, you know, Brian, you think back, I don't know what your first computer was, but mine was probably an Apple II. And now looking today at where we can get, you know, a 1 terabyte hard drive for what it would cost for a keyboard on one of those old Apple II, it's just amazing how much computing power is out there. And I don't know what the next step is, but defeating people seems to be much in line with it.
It's funny you should mention the iPad, because I've wanted to get an iPad for a while now, but I'm holding out because I presume that the iPad 2 will probably be out in about 3 or 4 months.
And yeah, probably, maybe even sooner than that, maybe even the next couple months. It seems like some of the new added features will, not necessarily something I'd be interested in. It was just cut to the chase. I couldn't wait. I had to have one, so
sure.
I got it, and it's just fascinating. And that got me to thinking about some different...
Well, actually, let me just make one mention here. The reason I'm waiting, and that plays into what we're talking about here, is that I presume that iPad 2, which is going to come out just over a year after the first iPad, is going to be a significant upgrade. And to think that it's going to be such a significant upgrade in just 1 year, I mean, it tells you a little bit about the increases in processing power that are going on.
Not to mention all the add-ons they're going to be able to put on. I know the main feature is going to be a front-facing and rear-facing camera for various whatever and applications and that will be using that. But, you know, Brian, there's a sinister side of computer. Of course, it takes people to program computers and so forth. And I was watching on television this tremendous program, if you haven't seen it yet, it's Brad Meltzer's Decoded. And if you haven't been watching this, I encourage you to DVR it or whatever. But they made mention on one of the latest episodes of some computer-related technology. And one of the things that really caught my attention is predicting the future. For as long as mankind's been walking the planet, there have been different religions whose writings have attempted to predict the future. And not only just religions, but there have been all sorts. Every culture, be it Native American, be it whatever, have seers and prophets. And so when you think of our age, the current modern age, the technology age, well, it's only natural that technology would be used to attempt to do that. And there have been several attempts at this. And one of the most recent ones and one of the most interesting ones I found that he discussed was the WebBot. And the WebBot project uses mathematical computations, but most the thing that intrigues me most is if you're going to tap into the human consciousness, that's been difficult to do throughout history other than mankind's writings and literature. But in our lifetime, in this generation, we have the Internet. We have the sum of most human knowledge available at our fingertips. Believe it or not, Brian, I don't know if you know this, the Internet is for more than looking up pornography.
Really?
There is a lot of valid information on there. And not just information like you get on Wikipedia, not just information you get through entertainment. You get research, you get blogs, you get news, you get opinion. And what the WebBot project has done is it has an algorithm that searches throughout the World Wide Web, as we used to call it in its infancy, and searches for terms, searches for trends, searches for opinions, thoughts, and prophecies, and takes all these through, and they're very secretive about the algorithm that they've used. It was created actually all the way back in 1997 originally to predict stock market trends. Of course, greed would have be the creator of this project, but suddenly it began making more dark, dire predictions, and that's been one of the criticisms of the WebBot project is it doesn't seem to have happy news for us. The creator of the WebBot project was a man named Cliff High, who, along with his associate George Ure, called themselves, of all things, a great name, I thought, the Time Monks. And they've been very secretive about their methodology and the algorithms used to do this, but I basically gave you a summary of what it does. It just searches the World Wide Web for trends, ideas, thoughts, predictions, taking into account monetary things, educational things, political ideas, and have come up with various predictions. Now,
what are some of these predictions?
you know, some of these have come true, very true. And then there have, of course, been misses. Let me give you some of the most famous claimed hits by the WebBot project. The Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. In January 2003, when the Space Shuttle Columbia was destroyed upon reentry to Earth, the WebBot project predicted during January of 2003 there would be a maritime disaster. Well, now, that doesn't exactly jibe with a space shuttle disaster. However, a lot of people jumped on that and called it that because, of course, the Columbia would be considered a ship of sorts. But the same year, there was a double-decker ferry which had a collision with a cargo vessel in Bangladesh where 130 people died, and it was a major disaster. And so some people are attributing it to one of the others. But the most famous thing, of course, that it predicted was allegedly the September 11th attacks and Hurricane Katrina. But on a smaller scale, it also claims to have predicted the Dick Cheney hunting accident where he shot one of his hunting buddies, and also the BP oil spill. What I find fascinating about the WebBot project, though,
well, let me stop you right there here very quickly. What were the exact predictions for 9/11 and Katrina?
Well, that's what is so murky about all this. They don't necessarily release the machine doesn't spit out a prediction per se. What it does, however, is give them a series of keywords through which they try to piece together something. Let's say, for example, in Hurricane Katrina, there is a large amount of keywords such as maybe hurricane, natural disaster, flooding, death, and a specific time frame given. And what they do is they try to put all these together and come up with some sort of prediction in advance, and that's what happened in those particular circumstances, were these repetitive keywords that seem to be specifically pointing to a flood event, natural disaster somewhere in the Gulf region of the United States. Now then, you could say, well, any fool could predict during the height of hurricane season, at a particularly super active hurricane season, that yes, a shot in the dark here, a hurricane is going to hit somewhere in the Gulf Coast and do a lot of flooding. What I find far more interesting than the hits are the misses, because a lot of times we're not even sure if these are going to be misses until we have some time put between. Now, especially since the predictions seem to be somewhat open to interpretation, let's say. For example, some of the misses that have come about from the WebBot project are a massive earthquake in Vancouver, Canada, in the Pacific Northwest. Does that get your attention, Brian?
Yeah.
December 12, 2008.
It's a fail.
Did not occur.
Fail.
However, some of these are more open to interpretation. For example, beginning in 2009, a complete collapse of the U.S. dollar. Now then, while that hasn't happened yet, we certainly have been in economic turmoil since then, and so 50 years from now, could we look back and is it possible that this prediction could come true? Well, it's certainly possible that with hindsight, we could see that. Furthermore, it predicted the U.S. dollar completely collapses, or, and how they make the determination between these two, or Israel bombs Iran somewhere during the early days of Barack Obama's administration. Now, those things, again, didn't happen, but, again, we are in economic turmoil, and, again, there has been increasing hostilities between Israel and Iran. Now, could 20 years from now we look back and see some events that we're missing right now that did lead to such a thing? Again, it's possible. Some of the ones I find the most interesting, though, is from July 11, 2010 onward, civil unrest will take place, possibly driven by food prices skyrocketing and the devaluation of the dollar. Again, I think it's way too early to call that one a miss. In October 2010, release of...
Well, actually, let me go back to that one right there. I mean, That prediction, I mean, many people could have made a prediction similar to that in 2009, for example.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, it's not really... I mean, I'll just say this about predicting the future. I mean, I think that you can spot trends based on the past. For example, you know, a perfect example would be what we usually discuss with professional wrestling. I mean, you look at the death of WCW, and you look at the what contributed to that, and you see the same things happening in TNA, and it's not hard to figure out that they're not on the right path. But the idea of predicting the future, particularly long-term, like making actual predictions of events as opposed to trends, I have a hard time believing that that is possible. I know that you linked on Facebook to the story about the black box, I believe it was called, and basically right. Random number generators that should always generate random numbers, but occasionally there are spikes which correspond to great worldwide events, events where perhaps the global consciousness was all thinking of an event at the same time, and these generators apparently went nuts shortly before 9/11, not after, before. That to me is fascinating. But again, that's a very short window of time. Like I'm sure that there are, you know, we could get someone on here to talk about quantum physics and the possibility of perhaps remembering the future from a very short period of time prior to the event happening. But looking long term, I have a hard time believing that such a thing is possible. And you know, with a lot of these, like especially when you look back at Nostradamus's predictions, I mean, they're nothing is ever specific. You've got to, you know, you've got to transpose letters, or you've got to make you've got to certain predictions over the years have I guess certain things he's written have predicted different things as years have gone by. Say one stanza maybe predicted JFK's assassination, but later they're like, oh no, it predicted this event here. So, you know, to me, to see an accurate, I want to see like an accurate prediction, like such and such is going to happen on such and such a date at such and such a time. And I want it years in advance, and I want it to happen exactly as was predicted. Otherwise, I find a hard time believing these things.
Well, the only drawback with that is, and again, sometime on here, I will discuss universal time and some quantum physics ideas that I've discussed with various quantum physicists. And there is actual scientific evidence that the future, to a degree, can be determined. But that's a different discussion for a different day. This, however, what I find different from, say, a Nostradamus or some ancient prophet or some Native American tradition is that there does seem to be science behind this, mathematics behind this, trending. And let's face it, I mean, the old adage that those who do not heed history are doomed to repeat it, there is truth to that. And so by using past historical events to predict mankind, I think has some degree of science to it. And it's debatable. And again, as far as getting specific goes, the problem with specifics is we don't know what something in the future looks like. Someone in 1969, as they were putting man on the moon, could never possibly have predicted the internet that we have today, because it looked like we were going macro with science then. We were getting bigger, further out, and farther away. People weren't thinking that the future was not rocket cars going down the street or transporting each other through devices like on Star Trek, but instead it was in small portable devices carrying around human knowledge the size of a telephone. So we can't necessarily always see, and you can see how someone even as recent as the 1960s or 1970s could have seen a future glimpse of the products we have today, the technology we have today, and been totally confounded by it, and may have lacked the terminology at that time to explain it. So I think doing a future prediction using limited knowledge of what's going to happen, especially technology-wise, is going to be very difficult.
I agree that let's say that a man in the 16th century managed to see into the 21st century, and it had to try to explain a 747. You know, he might use the term bird or something of that nature. You know, I understand that, but...
Or angel or...
Angel, sure.
Thing like that.
But at the same time, I mean, if you're a prophet in the 1970s, I mean, you should be able to determine that in such and such a year, a major political figure perhaps would be assassinated. I mean, you should be able to make very clear what's going to happen and on such and such a date, because it's not like in 30 years the calendar is going to be radically different or anything like that. I mean, some of these predictions, I mean, there should be at least some predictions that are dead on if it's possible to see the future.
So here, let's put the WebBot project to exactly that. Let's nail it to one future prediction, and then I'll turn the show back over to you. Future prediction from the WebBot project. See if this sounds familiar, Brian. A major catastrophe in, can you guess what year?
2012.
The WebBot project has gained most of its notoriety for contributing to the 2012 phenomenon by predicting that a cataclysm will devastate the planet in the year 2012, possibly a reversing of Earth's magnetic poles. Haven't we heard that over and over again? Or, here we go, a small series of nuclear attacks leading up to a major attack during the year. Again, there seems to be a great discrepancy in what's going to cause all this, but nevertheless, the prediction does not necessarily call for a complete end to the world, and again, doesn't that sound familiar?
But again, if these web bots are basically scouring the internet for keywords and this sort of thing, I mean, it only makes sense that concern over 2012 would be something that would pop up.
That's exactly right, and referring back to BrianAlvarez.com, apparently Betelgeuse will still be around in 2012. The twin star's not going to explode around that time, according to a news article posted there at BrianAlvarez.com. So there is some hope, I guess, if you live near Betelgeuse, that it's going to life will continue.
It is fascinating. We've got two 2012-related stories up there, the first being that Betelgeuse could, in fact, explode, supernova, and there was one story with one guy claiming that it's, you know, if it explodes, it could explode within the year, and it will be so bright, it will be like we will have two suns. And then, of course, there's another story that we've also got on the site, which basically points out that there's no guarantee that this thing is going to supernova anytime soon. And even if it did, it's so far away, it would not be anything near the size of a second sun in our sky. But those two stories are up there. And also the story, two of them, in fact, about George Lucas, who I guess the original story, Seth Rogen, had noted that he was chatting with George, and I believe Steven Spielberg was there as well, and he said that Spielberg was rolling his eyes at this, but George was talking about how he firmly believed that the world was going to end in 2012. And then there was the follow-up story in which one of his representatives wrote a comical email basically saying that George does not, in fact, believe this at all, and quite frankly, I don't know. I'd be surprised if he really believed this, because, I mean, I don't know. If you knew the world, or you firmly believed the world was ending next year, I mean, I don't know. Would you still be working on putting out Star Wars Blu-rays?
Well, all I can say about that is it just takes one time to go back and rewatch The Phantom Menace to no longer care what George Lucas thinks about anything, because clearly the man's insane. So
he's already had his apocalypse.
He's already had his apocalypse, and it was Jar Jar Binks, absolutely.
Now, one last story I wanted to talk about with you here. This one is interesting. This is from The National. Thousands of secret files on New Zealand's UFC, UFO reports are set to be made public nearly 32 years to the day after our most famous sighting. Files include every witness account of unidentified flying objects reported to authorities since the early 1950s. There's 2,000 pages in 12 volumes, and I wanted to get your thoughts on this because I am always interested in government documents that are released by the government about unidentified flying objects. Because
absolutely. I also have always been very intrigued by the fact that the UFO phenomenon seemed to peak between the late 1930s and the 1950s. There seemed to be a very a gigantic leap in the number of UFOs that were seen. And there is a school of thought that, again, this is for the teaser for a future show, that these are, in fact, not alien crafts, but more likely experimental time travel devices. And there is a very scientific and there is a very possible, especially when you get into quantum physics, explanation for what people are seeing, the motions thereof, and why we can't contact these things, nor can they contact us. It's a very interesting idea, and I think in hindsight, if we put some of these stories together in the time frame that this is happening in, I think there's a very interesting explanation for some of this.
I know this one is very close to your heart, so we'll do a show on this at some point. But
it involves atomic energy. I'll just throw that teaser out there.
The interesting thing about documents purportedly from the government is, obviously, everybody has heard, listening to this show, of the Majestic 12 documents, if you've not Googled them. But the best supposed documents, and obviously there's controversy about whether or not these documents are real. In fact, there should be great controversy, because these would be, you know, Earth history-changing documents were they to be legitimate. But the best ones are always the ones that are leaked in this fashion. The documents that are released by the government, the Project Blue Book files and that sort of thing, I mean, it's kind of the... it's always like, there's never really anything in there. You know what I mean? There's like some interesting stories, there's some interesting reports, but... I mean, the idea of the government releasing 2,000 pages of files on UFOs, I mean, I know that some people get excited, but really, I would guess it's kind of like WikiLeaks, where you know, the vast majority of that stuff was really nothing exceptional and probably boring.
The government has a very vested interest in playing this story how they want to, and it's not just the causing mass hysteria, which is usually the go-to answer for why the government would want to suppress this. I think it's far more plausible that the reason they would be interested in suppressing this information is because we're learning from it. We're developing technology from it. There is military application for these things, such as the stealth fighter and various types of weaponry, for not wanting to release where the technology goes next. And so I think if there is, in fact, reality behind these government documents, and there really has been contact with some sort of advanced civilization, then the government certainly has a vested interest in keep playing those cards close to their vest, and it's not just because of upsetting the public.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you very much for doing the news today, and hopefully we'll have you on every week. All of this news available, as always, at brianalvarez.com. Head up there. There are news stories added whenever I catch a glimpse. If you ever see a story or you have comments or anything like that, you can always send those to brianalvarezafterdark@gmail.com. We're going to be back in just a moment with Steve Sims. We'll be talking the singularity, transhumanism, and more. You're listening to Brian Alvarez After Dark at brianalvarez.com. We are back here on the show. We are joined by Steve Sims, talk a number of different topics today, including Ray Kurzweil's book. In fact, I just got his book, in fact, talking about singularities. The link is up at brianalvarez.com. And Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. I didn't know they had bookstores in your hometown.
We have Kindles here.
Is the Kindle the greatest device you've ever seen, or what?
The singularity is getting closer as I get these e-readers.
Yes, that's true, isn't it? That is a good segue, good tying it in.
Now, Steve, you talked about this a couple of days ago, and tell everybody a little bit about the singularity, the concept of it, and how you got interested in this in the first place.
All right, well, the concept of the singularity has been floating around for a while, as in the 20th century, as people got more and more, as society kind of got more and more technologically advanced. People started thinking, well, we're increasing the rate of our, I'm sorry, I'm actually leaving work at the moment, our technological intelligence so quickly that it's like computers are going to be able to do things better, many things, if not everything, better than human brains can. For example, a classic example is the Deep Blue a computer beating Garry Kasparov in chess a few years back. when I was born, that was impossible. By now, it's just commonplace. No person could keep up with a computer in chess that's properly programmed. That was one of the things that got me involved in the first place. And there's been a number of writings by scientists that are kind of philosophers, kind of futurists, and one of them is a guy by the name of Ray Kurzweil. He's a very famous, very legitimate scientist and inventor. He's invented a lot of things. Excuse me, I've done some walking here, but I'll calm down in just a second. He's come out with several books that led up to one that he wrote in 2005 called The Singularity Is Near. And his philosophy, or his general summation, if you were to try and put it in one or two sentences, is that man's technological creations are rapidly gaining such speed that they will resemble intelligence, and by the year 2045, they will bypass biological intelligence to such a point that man and machine can merge. That's a summary.
All right. I was actually...
Now we're going to go into this in much greater detail over the next hour, but
yes,
to try and keep the answer... Try and not rattle on and on and on and get 3 minute answers. That's the summary.
Yeah, I was reading the book last night, and I think the date he gave for, machine intelligence being indistinguishable from biological intelligence was actually 2029, and the singularity would occur in 2045.
That's correct.
I was talking with Carl Stern about this before the show began, and we were talking about the IBM supercomputer versus Jeopardy contestants, which is coming up in February, and they've done
But wait a second, I already know the result.
So they've already had the result. They did the test run, and the computer won.
Yeah, we're not supposed to spoil that, are we?
Well, I mean, there's still time.
It's been on the news and a lot of things.
The
yeah.
humans could make a comeback for the actual taping.
If they're going to make a comeback, they better have a great set of foreign objects to use against the computer.
You know, water.
Water, or maybe, I don't know, what would be a good foreign object to use against the computer? Maximo could kiss him. That would be good.
Sure.
No, the point is that they've picked out a point in time at which a computer has surpassed humans in the ability to think up these questions. Which computers, being a computer program, by the way, is there a lot of echo to you?
There's a little bit of an echo, yeah.
Okay, well, I'll get rid of that in a second. Just like the Deep Blue testing, you happen to have the match at the exact time, at the first possible time when they were confident that computers could do it. In 3 or 4 years after that, the challenge was meaningless. Computers were way beyond what humans could do in chess in speed and ability to analyze all possible outcomes. The same thing with Jeopardy. Right now, it's a curiosity factor. In 3 or 4 years, as computer speed increases and so many people are working so hard at improving how efficient they are, then, you know, the true Jeopardy Tournament of Champions would have 3 computers.
Now, it is interesting when you look at the growth of humanity and obviously how long it took for human beings to evolve and then to create an agricultural society and the buildup of technology. And obviously there's been a gigantic leap forward in the last 100 years. And really, there's been a huge leap forward every year because the idea espoused in the book is that people look at when they look at history, where is history going to go? They often look at, okay, well, it took such and such amount of time to get from square one to here, and so it's going to take such and such amount of time to get from here to such and such a point in the future. When in reality, everything is speeding up exponentially. And so,
geometrically rather than just mathematically.
Exactly. And so, you know, I used to always think, you know, maybe someday there's going to be technology where, you know, they can take my brain and put it in another body or whatever the case might be. And you think of all these futuristic things that you read about in sci-fi and that sort of thing. And you think
in his other books, he actually does address certain topics that are, you know, assuming the singularity happens, then what? What kind of bodies do we have, and et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
This was published in 2005, and he's had subsequent books.
But the point is, you think about these things and you think, my God, it's so far in the future and I'll be dead, never have a chance to experience any of this stuff. When you read this book, he believes that things are moving at such a rate that we are there within our lifespan. Like, unless you're 90 and in ill health, you know, if you can keep yourself healthy for another 20, 30 years, you will not have to worry about aging and death and all of these things. And it's you know, it's hard for people to really comprehend this idea that it could be right around the corner.
You're stating his case very well. For example, he was on a very famous radio interview with one of the typical bookstore, you know, when book authors write books, they go on book tours and they do TV and radio. And this particular host was 69.
I just listened to this interview, actually, today.
And in 2005, she asked him, what the obvious question would be if I were interviewing him. Okay, I'm such and such a year. Do you think I'll die? She didn't put it in those words, but that's basically it. And he tried to be as nice as possible about it. And he says, well, if you can fight off cancer, which, of course, is the one thing he always mentions in his books, is humans haven't got a handle around yet. They haven't really made as big advances on. But if you can fight off cancer and keep yourself healthy for about 15 years, he said, then you can get into what we might go in later to reversal of aging. That's a very interesting concept, is that the singularity just doesn't happen all at once, and you just keep growing and growing and growing, and suddenly in 2029 you merge, or 2045 you merge. As each year comes and each technological advance or each amount of technology advances, I think, in 10 or 15 years, he thinks that most diseases can be reverse engineered.
The one thing that I was questioning, and I've not read the entire book yet, but when...
It is a long book.
The Singularity book. When he talks about the idea of this exponential growth, and he's got these exact dates down, 2029 and 2045, he's actually, it seems to me, he's doing the exact thing that he said you really can't do, because this is presuming that nothing is going to come up to prevent growth. There's not going to be, for example, you know, computer chips. Obviously, we're moving into quantum computing right now, but there could come a point where, you know, you reach the level where you cannot double your speed every year or every 6 months or every 3 months or whatever.
And that's correct.
And I wonder what the limits are going to be.
Well, as I see it, there are two, and these are the two major criticisms they have. One is that increasing your technological abilities is a expensive process. And if society goes through, you know, downtimes in employment and goes through just poor economic cycles, they're not going to be able to devote money and funding at the level that would keep technologically advancing at a rapid pace. The other is, of course, that the brain is a very complex instrument, and it's not yet certain that he's correct in his premise that you can increase your understanding of how the brain works at something roughly equivalent to Moore's Law, where your knowledge increase doubles every 18 months. Mm-hmm. The brain is turning out to be more complex to reverse engineer or to find out exactly how it works than people, even people within, you know, brain science, are surprised at how slow their progress has been.
Now, that does also bring up the point of when efforts were made to understand the human genome. You know, when they first began this work, the idea was, oh my God, this is going to take forever, because it took such and such amount of time for us to just decode, you know, 5% or whatever. But it was the same sort of thing where there was exponential growth in the processes used to do this, and so it ended up getting done significantly faster than they presumed.
That's right. As he mentioned in his radio interview, you know, the first adopters are always the rich and things don't work. So you get $2,000 VCRs that always eat the tape in 1979, that eat the tape that you put in there. And by 1985, they're $100, and cell phones are like bricks. 15 years ago, and now they're getting so small, they'll be like Dick Tracy wristwatches.
Sure.
So yes, so that there's certainly reason to believe that things are going to get, that most of his assumptions about the rapid advancement of I don't want to say human technology. That's not the proper word. There's probably a better word for it. But you're going to get so much advancement in your understanding and ability to do and mimic a lot of the functions of the brain that you're, in essence, going to be a computer by 2029. And by 2045, you'll be able to use that brain to power all your biological functions, and theoretically, at that point, you're immortal.
I wanted to...
You're a machine. I mean, you know, machines can be destroyed. I don't mean to be immortal in a big philosophical sense, but I mean in that the aging process is ended.
I want to... we'll talk about that as far as the immortality thing here in a second. Because
for most people, that's the most interesting question out of all of this.
Sure. But there are obviously fears.
I don't have to die?
There
would be a huge question.
Sure. We'll jump into that in a second. But first off, I want to read this because it was something somebody put on our board that kind of relates to what you just said. He wants to hear us touch on the horrifying implications of transhumanism if it were only affordable to a small elite portion of the general population. To me, nothing is quite as disturbing as the potential of a society in which the wealthy are able to extend their lives long beyond that of normal citizens. The oligarchy that would inevitably arise from such a situation would effectively rule the world. With the limited resources we have at our disposal on Earth, you'd almost have to assume this elite class would do anything possible to keep these advances out of the reach of the other 4 billion humans. And the point you made earlier was kind of addressing that in the sense that, yes, when this technology is first available, and a lot of the stuff we'll talk about on this show... I mean, there are people already working on, like, reverse engineering the brain is already going on. It was going on 5 years ago, and they're still working on it. But at the beginning, yes, this is going to be very, very expensive, and only the very, very rich will have access to it. But it is inevitable, at least according to this book, that eventually the price is going to go down. And the technology is going to get more advanced, as Steve noted. In fact, I'll read what was written in the book about this. The when things first
By the way, just out of curiosity, what page are you reading from? And then I'll see if my print version, which I have with me, matches your Kindle version.
No page number, sorry.
Oh, okay. Never mind then.
He knows that things start out unaffordable and they don't work very well, and that's where it's going to be at the beginning. And later, they're going to work better and still be expensive. And ultimately, they are going to work great and will be nearly free. And the point that he made, or one of the examples that he gave, was the fact that you can find a farmer in Asia today that has a device, a cell phone, where basically he can access much of the knowledge of human history immediately. A farmer in Asia. So. Yes, at the beginning there could be fears, but his theory, and he's an optimist, is that ultimately there's nothing to worry about here.
He does seem to take that point, and later, and as we go on later, you and I will get into our own opinions of this after we've finished setting up exactly how he presents his hypothesis. But he really does seem to see no problems with this at all.
No, he
seems to think it's only beneficial, and nothing could possibly. That's putting words into his mouth. He just doesn't see if he does see anything, he's certainly not listing anything that he thinks could go wrong with this whole process.
Now, when you look at the advancements in technology, there's been a lot of change in recent decades, and some people will say that life is worse as a result of this. You know, we spend all this time in front of the computer, we're on the phone all the time, we don't spend time outdoors and that sort of thing. But many others would argue that life's much better now with all of this technology. And if you look back 30 years, there were, in fact, look at great novels, 1984. You know, there are all sorts of books about the horrors of this technological advancement. And I think most people would argue that it really is not all that bad. And quite frankly, it's pretty cool. So I guess...
Let me ask you then your opinion. Within 5 years from now, if you have an iPad in any place on planet Earth, well, not most any populated place on planet Earth except the ultra-poorest, you'll be able to have access to every book ever written.
Within 5 years?
Within 5 years of your electronic device. Google will finish scanning the things that aren't already electronic, and between Amazon and others, they'll offer things on their reading devices, and you'll essentially have the entire library of the universe. Is that a good thing?
I don't think it's going to happen in 5 years, but...
Well, okay, 10 years.
I would say that's a good thing. That's a great thing.
Well, is that what you want? having that access, then what do you want to give up in place of that? Could we devote that money to, you know, feeding people instead? Is it necessary to have, you know, books that are out of print? Are there reasons that they're out of print, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, there are always economic costs for something that you devote all your resources to. And one of the things I'm going to argue later on is that and I think others have argued, too, that even if this is possible, I'm not quite sure how, if it's all going to be, you know, bed of roses.
Well, why don't you talk a little bit about what he is expecting in 2045? What will the world be like in 2045?
He is expecting a kind of a world where everyone can, everyone has the same access to the same knowledge everywhere. Everyone is, if not equal, that they're all, in essence, have a similar mind and intellect. And I think and a lot of it is genetic and stuff, but I think he thinks that what he's really finding so much more so than, oh, life will be, you know, filled with baseballs and footballs and everybody will get to finally see the team that never wins the World Series win the World Series. He's much more interested in, like, there will be an increase in intelligence, in the knowing of things, an increase in longevity, and an increase in the people who are able to, what's the word, go backwards on their disease, who are currently very sick and will be much less sick than the way they are now. I don't know that, you know, it's kind of like the religious arguments about, well, if you want to go to heaven, what is heaven around? When there's only good around you, how boring is that? And that's one of the complaints that is frequently drawn up against Kurzweil, is that why would we want to get, you know, we want to get rid of disease. That much is fine, but is there a process where you want to go where everybody is good? Is there a place and a time where you want to go where everything is good? And can there be any good if there isn't any bad to reflect it against or to compare it against?
The aging process.
I wouldn't say he sees utopia so much as he sees a place that's beyond whether you even discuss whether it's utopia. It's just like, did you ever see the Star Trek Next Generation episode of Bynars?
No.
Bynars, well, if you did, he's in essence seeing something like that. That's in my associative thinking that I was mentioning 2 days ago. That's the associative thinking that he sees as the world is living all in constant mental communication with each other. Of course, I'm not sure everybody wants to know what everybody else is really thinking about them. That's probably a good thing that you can't read other people's minds.
The questions about the aging process are always interesting because the idea of these diseases that, and he considers aging a disease, by the way, mm-hmm. these diseases of man that lead to your demise, the idea of them being I guess these problems being solved. I mean, it's not only solved, but reversed, as you noted. So
it does, because he's got this term in there called GNR, which is, the G is genetics, the N is nanotechnology, and the R is robotics. And they all fit together. You reverse backwards on the disease by the advancement in nanotechnology, creating little robots that can go in and restructure the gene structure to where it's correct. He goes through this at great length, in like 90 pages of length in the middle of the book.
Yeah, the idea, I mean, obviously the questions that would arise would be regarding overpopulation, for example, if people are not passing away. And
yeah, even that radio interview, he didn't really have an answer for that one.
No, obviously, one would presume that once our technology has advanced to the point where we have reversed aging, presumably somewhat soon thereafter, we will be able to populate planets outside of the Earth, or even take a planet like Mars and reseed it and do what is necessary. And really, when you think about the technology, I mean, all of the issues that we look at today.
I'm sure we couldn't do that right now if there were a meteor crashing down on us.
Yeah,
you'd have to tell people you're leaving planet Earth and you're never coming back, and you're going to have a limited diet, and it's really your children's children that are going to make the society there. You're just there to seed the population and that sort of thing. But it probably could be done on an emergency basis now.
Sure, but I mean, obviously, those ideas would be explored as far as overpopulation is concerned, and there are vast there are vast areas of land left here on the Earth, and presumably all of the issues nowadays with filling up those areas and such, you know, a sufficiently technologically advanced civilization should be able to solve a lot of those problems.
Yes, you would think, and in fact, that is the intelligence that he actually hopes will happen. There is something called Moore's Law. Gordon Moore was the founder of Intel, and he created a little rule of thumb. Actually, I think it's later come out, since he's retired from Intel, that somebody else said it. You know, somebody else said it. He picked up on it, but he popularized it rather than created it. And if I've got that wrong, I don't mean any aspersions to anybody, but it's known as Moore's Law, and that is the power of computing chips doubles every 18 months.
Sure.
And for a long time, that was essentially correct, and Kurzweil is taking that one theory, which is basically accepted as correct, and applying it to all technology for the next 18 years, and saying, well, if we really do that, then this is where human intelligence will be, and then you're correct, we would be able to go out and populate other planets. I'm not so sure about other planets. I mean, light year travel is light year travel, but we would be able to populate at least something beyond just Earth.
Well, what is interesting, I've listened to Michio Kaku talk about Moore's Law, and for a while there was this fear that Moore's Law was in fact going to break down around 2020, and there would be a time where, okay, we've reached the capacity, this thing can't get any smaller, and your computer...
Yeah. It was not going to be that the law was wrong, it's just going to be that the humans couldn't work with anything so small.
But that is already, they believe that is now... That fear is a thing of the past, because they are, as things go with technology, finding ways to get around those issues.
I wouldn't be surprised if they don't have to be any size at all, that you make them virtual, where they occupy space for a time and then they're not there anymore. That's what nanotechnology... That's too bold of a statement. That's one of the things that nanotechnology is trying to find out if they can do.
Now, let me ask you this question. How old are you?
52
years old. So
53 in May.
All right, so you're actually younger than the example that I'm giving here. But when people are young, it seems that, you know, obviously a lot of young people, they have no fear of dying. They do all these crazy things. Then you get a little older and maybe you have a family or whatever, and you start, you know, examining your mortality, and then you hit your midlife crisis and you're really thinking about, my God, you know, someday I'm going to die. But if you look at studies of happiness, you'll find that as people hit their 60s and 70s, they actually get more happy, and they stop worrying about these things. And often, you know, you'll hear people that, you know, their time is coming, they're very old, and they're ready to go. And then you come up with this idea of,
I can see that. I can see that. Even in my life, I can see it. If I have my health, I can see where I would be perfectly happy at 60 if even I had very little material things.
Sure. But, I mean, how will that change with the idea of, okay, you no longer have to die? I mean, are we going to have people that choose death, or will it be a deal where when you are 80 now, you will not have these back issues and knee issues and pain and such, and you won't be ready?
That's a good question. Perhaps we should be fair to Kurzweil, and he would say the aging process will stop, that any machine can be destroyed, and any life form can be destroyed. The aging process will stop, and you won't die outside of horribly extraneous accidents.
Well,
I think that is his point. I don't think he's literally saying you can't be indestructible. You can't die.
Okay,
I don't think he's saying that.
Okay,
I think he's saying the aging process will stop.
All right, let's look at that, though. Let's examine this here for a second. When I think of my own death, I always think, I plan on being 125 years old, for example, and I go to sleep and never wake up. That's the way I'd like to go. I don't think, man, I'll be in this horrible accident and be cut in half, and they'll be unable to save me, and that's how I'm going to go. Now, if we reach this point where we can halt or reverse aging, then won't it stand to reason that the only way that people will die is horrible, violent ends?
Yeah, where a meteor strikes the planet and kills people and stuff like that.
That's terrible.
Well, it is terrible, but... Is there may not be, and maybe technology will advance to the way where it can make an entity indestructible, where a certain life form, and perhaps it will be a human life form or a partially human life form, doesn't ever have to die and can withstand anything. But I don't know that he's even addressing that. He's trying to make just a point that applies, you know, that gets us to the growth of intelligence in the year 2050. And he doesn't really go into, you know, what will happen in 2150, in 2250, in 2350. He's just saying the aging process will stop. Technology will still be increasing. Humans will get to be gigantically super smart. And they'll be able to do whatever they decide to do is the best thing with all that extra intelligence far beyond what we have now. One of the things that always struck me odd is, Brian, is he keeps using intelligence rather than understanding, which is almost as if there'll be the world's, you'll have a body of knowledge of every, you know, everything. You'll know every fact, but will you actually be able to be wise out of it? Will you have any understanding, and will you know right from wrong, if, or is right from wrong just a computer program?
Now, the one thing, when you mentioned he didn't mention anything as far as, like, the 21st, 22nd centuries, he didn't do great specifics, but he did mention that he expects that Earth will be a Type 2 civilization by the middle of the 22nd century.
Yeah, I thought he was stretching there. I thought that's way too far off to guess what will... Anyway, go ahead.
Well, he's okay, for those that have never heard of this before, a Type 1 civilization is a civilization that is able to harness the energy of its own planet. So so that would be a Type 1. A Type 2 harnesses the energy of the sun, and a Type 3 harnesses the energy of the entire galaxy. So these are all...
And there are bridges that you can exist on between these types.
Sure, but in general, I mean, it seems like, you know, the jump from... being able to harness the energy of the Earth, to being able to harness the energy of the sun, to being able to harness the energy of the galaxy, those seem like three gigantic jumps. But to him, technology is advancing so quickly that he's looking at type 1 to 2 to 3 in like a matter of a couple centuries. And keep in mind that when you think of how long human beings have existed on this Earth, we are not even considered a type 1 yet. We are sub-type 1. So this would be going from nothing... type 0, as we are right now, to a type 1, I guess, later this century, and then a type 2 in like 100 years, and a type 3 shortly thereafter. That seems like a big jump.
It does, but if you're doubling the intelligence inside every living human entity every year after 2029, it almost seems to me that before too long, everybody literally knows everything, and there isn't any more doubling to do because there isn't any more intelligence to... The amount of intelligence on Earth is finite. So I almost wonder if his equation isn't going to work because it breaks down because there isn't any further growth. There isn't anything more to learn. At that point, you have to become wise and understanding.
Let me ask you this question. When you think of what you just mentioned, as far as, like, you know, you'll have the capacity to just know everything. You know, obviously,
yeah,
you know,
you will know every fact. In essence, your computer will be a giant Google search engine, which will have the correct link on the first time to the correct answer for any question that pops up.
When you think of all these advances in technology and such, the question that people might have is, what the hell are people going to do with their lives? And so, I guess, to you, tell everybody some of his ideas about living in virtual reality worlds.
To be honest, I don't remember. I got the book. When we talked about this last night at 11, I got the book and started rereading it again, but I hadn't read it since 2005. So can you fill me in?
I'm just talking about the idea that virtual reality will be such that you will be able to...
You won't be living in a space. The space will be living inside of you.
Basically, yes. You'll be able to... I mean, when people think of virtual reality now, they think of you put on a helmet... And you see some stuff, and it's very crude. But, I mean, his idea is basically, you know, the virtual reality will be indistinguishable from reality.
A true second life.
Sure.
Well, that sounds very interesting. In theory, or in reality, where we are right now that he brings up, and I think others bring up a lot, is the problems with... the turning intelligence into understanding is the problem that is most clearly illustrated by teaching computers to speak, by teaching computers how to recognize speech even more so, and how to recognize, you know, if you're looking at a person, you're looking at their body language, and you're hearing their drawls and their accents and other things, you can tend to put together meanings that people are implying or that they're not saying directly or that... the words that if you just read them on a computer screen might tend to lead you in one direction, but they really mean something else. That's very common in human understanding. And that's been, as far as I can understand from people that wrote book reviews of his book and other scientists, is the part of brain research that has, in computer research, that has really puzzled computer scientists the most. They're not sure how to wrap their hands around how to tackle that problem.
And what's kind of interesting in the interview that he did, he was talking about the brain, and he was talking about to the host about, you know, keep yourself in shape and be healthy, and in 15 years, this, that, and the other thing. And he mentioned the brain, and he said something to the effect of, you know, keep your brain healthy, because issues with damage to the brain are very hard to fix. And I thought that was kind of strange, because, I mean, he's really talking about some massive changes to the world and really to the entire galaxy if we're type 3 by the middle of the 22nd or 23rd century. And you would think with that level of understanding, we'd be able to fix the brain.
And you would think, well, by then we may be able to. I think to Diane, the host he was talking to at that time, I think he was trying to make a point about the current state of the problems they have, where the problems lie in keeping old people alive long enough so that they can be fixed as medical knowledge increases, doubles every 18 months. So I took his answer to be more about specific to her and specific to people age 69, that if, you know, once you start getting a brain disease or Alzheimer's or whatever it might be that affects the brain, right now we don't have the knowledge, and we may not have that may be the last knowledge to come, and we may not be able to reverse engineer it in time before you pass away.
In the book he
clearly states that that's the case with cancer. Cancer is a big problem that modern science, at the time he wrote the book, that modern science was far away from. It wasn't right around the corner there was going to be a solution that he could see.
Well, it seems we've made big strides in the last 5 years. I mean, obviously, we do not have a cure or anything like that, but we seem to have made big strides in the last 5 years.
It does. It seems to me it's very funding intensive, though. The things that get funded get a lot of attention. There seems to be more levels of advancement on, and it makes you wonder whether that what it takes is just a lot of people throwing a lot of man hours and a lot of effort into doing the molecular research to figure out what's going wrong with the DNA or the gene to fix it. But then again, that's medical knowledge beyond the mind. That's where you start getting really, really technical.
Ken here says, on a discrete level, I would argue we are already entering a stage of transhumanism. It is the most stripped-down definition of transhuman, beyond human. I think we're... basically, he says, we're already merged with a network. I carry a tiny machine with me at all times, tethers me seamlessly into the internet. Through this conduit, I have instant access to the sum of all human knowledge. I can potentially know everything. I can instantly read millions of books. I can view my position on Earth and gain instant directions to anywhere I need to go. I can see anything. I can speak to anyone. In a small way, a decent smartphone can turn a human into essentially a god. This very idea would be unfathomable even 20 years ago. Now look at us. I want to get your thoughts, but I also want to mention, when he mentions phones, I mean, you know, this is kind of one of the things where when I read all of his predictions, I mean, I've talked about this many times, when you're trying to predict the future, it's so difficult to do, because you don't know, you just can't predict the big changes that people don't expect. And the example I'll give is the phone. You know, when I was in high school, you know, no one had a cell phone. Nobody. I mean, I'm 35 years old, and when I was in high school in 1993, I didn't know anybody with a cell phone. There were people that had pagers, but no cell phones. I think the cell phones, right around that time, I got my first cell phone, and it was really big, and it was really crude. And who would have thought, at the time that people were using pagers, that in like 20 years, phones would basically be used more as tiny computers than phones?
Well, yeah. I mean, as phones, as you can tell by the quality of this one, this smartphone I'm on, voice quality is the least important thing of this device I'm holding in my hand, by far. It really is a mini computer.
And has not changed, by the way, as someone who does radio. I mentioned this yesterday. The quality of a telephone line is exactly the same now as it was God knows how many. In fact, it's worse because landlines had much better call reception than cell phones. And you'd think that with all of these technological advances, I would be able to hear you over the phone as if you were in the room with me. And the closest we have to that is Skype.
Well, that's a scary, yes, it's a scary thing because it's, it, you know, but that's the point. In by 2029, I'll just be able to telepathically connect with you. And, I mean, even today, how many text messages were back and forth? That was more efficient than a conversation.
Exactly.
We could do what we were doing at our jobs and then stop, reply, go back to our jobs, know there's a message, finish what we're doing, and not have to put everything aside. And it's there's so much advantage to the things that we're doing technologically wise, but everybody is getting the smartphone, so the people who are still on top are still on top, and the people who are still on the bottom are still on the bottom. And I'm not sure if everybody gets the same technological advances at the same time, if we'll really become the egalitarian society that he thinks.
You know, there was an interesting...
In fact, you may be the very first topic you brought up from the start, that since the richest people will, by definition, have it first, because it's going to be a very expensive thing, is... That may be the biggest danger of all, that it never goes beyond them.
Well, one thing, I was just, what was I reading? Some celebrity, I forget who it was. Oh, it was, what the hell is his name? He was a guest host on Raw, but apparently got a hair transplant. There's like this huge scar across the back of his head now. And, you know, as noted, yes, the rich are going to have access to this technology early, but you have to think that the early technology is going to be very crude. And for example, the first people to get hair transplants, for example, those people are regretting that gravely today because very crude and they look horrible.
The first rich people who get this will regret it, but at some point in time, the 150th richest person in the world will get the version that works. And the question is does he turn around and let everybody else have it?
It's very likely that if you're afraid of the elite running amok with this technology, then you should pray they get it first. Because they're going to get the, you know what I mean? They're going to get the version of it, the version 1.0, which,
now. Or that could be Kurt's whole insidious plan.
It could be.
Could egalitarianize the entire planet.
Could be his entire
plan. Never thought of that.
I wanted to mention this because this was one of the most interesting things that I read in his book. Obviously, in this show, we're going to be talking a lot about the idea of UFOs and aliens. And, you know, I mentioned on the first show that I don't know what happened at Roswell, but I believe firmly that something happened there. Now, do I believe that an alien craft crashed? I don't know. I really don't because, again, the idea of a technology able to transverse the universe or travel through time or travel across dimensions, getting hit by lightning and crashing, I find that hard to believe. But when I read the book, he does not believe, he actually believes that we are alone in the universe because essentially the Drake equation is used to determine or I guess predict whether or not what the chances of life are elsewhere in the universe. And it's a series of equations based on what are the chances that a sun has a star? What are the chances, or a sun has accompanying planets? What are the chances the planets are in the right zone? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the Drake equation, the way that optimists look at it is there are potentially millions of civilizations in the galaxy. His theory is that, first off, even though he's an optimist, he looks at the worst-case scenarios. And if you use the Drake equation and you plug in worst-case scenarios for everything, you come up with one civilization in a galaxy. And currently we have one right now. It's us. That would mean we're alone. And his theory that once a civilization becomes capable of using radio, ironically, as we're doing this show, once they're capable of using radio, within 200 years, they're type 2, maybe type 3 civilizations. And his theory is that if that's the case, we should be well aware of life elsewhere in this galaxy. And we scan the galaxy, and it's silent. And he believes that how could you possibly have, you know, type 3 civilizations elsewhere in the galaxy and us be completely unaware of them? It makes no sense to him.
But, yeah, exactly. Well, and there's a lot of reasons why people, very smart thinkers and scientists, think that we could be alone. I'm still not so sure that the universe is so vast that the possibilities that there's nobody in the entire universe but us, that just strikes me as so unlikely. Because the universe being so vast and so many different stars, it strikes me as odd. Whether or not we're alone in the galaxy could be better, but the entire universe is just so big. So big. And he does. I mean, he goes on for about 30 pages of why we were probably alone in the universe.
I don't know if it was so much the universe or just our galaxy, because I agree that the universe is, I don't know, I find it hard to believe.
I mean, string theory posits that there are many universes, and so you can take everything we've got and multiply it by 10 or 11, theoretically.
Sure.
It's all very interesting. And a lot of science you can test. There are sciences, you know, molecular biology, social sciences you can test. But future predictions, you know, they're not right or wrong. There are people using the best evidence they have and their own knowledge to try and estimate as best they can where things will go. And there are many things, even his critics, I think, have always prefaced their comments and saying there's many things that he says they agree with. But a lot of this book is by people who are actually in brain research and other things, is highly thought of, and there's some things they disagree with, primarily the problems with, it's just not, the speed of understanding the brain is not, in reverse engineering it is not growing double every 18 months, that sort of thing.
I should know, by the way, there the book link for...
By the way, did you mention that he like proactively lists all his criticisms in the at the end of the book?
Oh yeah, he goes through one by one trying to shoot these things down,
like
Dave Meltzer on the board.
I can see he's doing straw mans. I mean, he's trying to, but
the book, the link is up at brianalvarez.com. You can go up there and check it out right now. I should note that I was talking to Carl Stern earlier about the future and attempting to predict the future, and the idea that most people who attempt to predict the future, they're predictions that are open to many interpretations, and I always look for a prediction where, okay, this is his prediction, he gives a date, so and so, and there are very, very few of those. I mean, obviously there are some, but I mean, you know you never see people predicting a great event on a certain day down to the great specifics.
People at the end of the year 2000 predicted, oh, a great tragedy will happen in the U.S. next year. But nobody said on September 11th, 2011,
sure,
Twin Towers will be hit and go down.
Yeah. Now, with Ray, he has made some predictions that he has, in fact, listed dates. And I thought one of them that was really interesting, I was looking at I can't remember what website it was. It may have even been on Wikipedia, but people that were critical of his predictions were noting some of them that he had gotten wrong. And I believe one of them that they listed that he got wrong was he claimed in 2009 or 2010 that there was going to be a company with a market share in excess of $1 trillion. And they noted that he had been wrong. And it was funny because like a week ago, I read an article about how Apple is poised to be the first $1 trillion company. And I thought that was astounding.
Well, it is astounding because you can drop the iPod and that little glass thing breaks and you have to buy a new one.
Sure.
And yet it, which I've done twice. So, I still have some complaints with the company. Why should it be the most valuable company of all time? But, you know, that's the way it is. And so he's right. He was right. He was a little late, but he was right. And that's even with perfectly testable predictions, It's more important to me is he seeing the process correctly rather than getting the exact date correct. If it's 2011 instead of 2008, but it still happens, and nobody's predictions are perfect all the time. You just, as you've said twice already here, too many things happen in the world to perfectly estimate what's going to happen in the future. But he's got an amazing amount of things right so far.
We've got a lot of interesting questions here on the board. A lot of people, I mean, when people hear about this, they think of the And I guess this is just natural, but you think of you expect the worst, and you think of, you know, my God, in 2045, you know, man merges with.
We haven't discussed that. If let's say everything he says happens in 2045, is that good?
Well, one of the main things that people bring up is man merging with machine, and they think of, like, you know, this metallic robot with a human face, and I don't really think that's exactly what he's talking about. And what would you say is his description of what it will be like in 2045?
The aging process stops, the disease process. So you have the same body that you have at the point in time in which your disease process and aging process stops, and your mind is able to function as if it were a giant computer, that it has that much data storage and internet accessibility. But I see it as still you look as if you did 5 years earlier, just slightly older because there's been slight aging, although most of the aging process has been stopped. I don't see, I don't even see androids like Data, to use an example. I still see the same human body with, if I understand what he's saying, with just not getting any older or getting disease.
He's got a quote here. He says, "This is not because humans will have become what we think of as machines today, but rather machines will have progressed to be like humans and beyond."
He would probably agree with that, a lot of that quote.
No, that is his quote.
It's a merger. I mean, it's a merger. It's the two becoming indistinguishable from each other. I guess that's the best way to put it, rather than merging. That one is capable of doing the other's functions and vice versa, and the intelligence just becomes one.
You know, I was always, you know, really...
It's hard to describe something that doesn't exist and has never existed before.
Sure. I was always really sad when Christopher Reeves passed away, because I firmly believed that someday he would walk again. And I've always kind of been fascinated by that, because there are a lot of different advances that are being made in terms of implants in the brain and deals where you could take, like, a paralyzed person and implant something in their brain where, you know, they can learn to think and control movements on a computer screen, for example. And, you know, once you've achieved that, to me it seems like at some point you should be able to create a body or a body part or a spine or some sort of I guess whatever would be required that could then be controlled by the brain in the same way, and essentially you could walk again. And I guess while the idea of a man who is mostly machine terrifies people, I mean, for people that know someone who is paralyzed, I mean, I don't see those people or the paralyzed person thinking, man, I would not want to walk again.
No, I would think they would. I would think that would be one of the benefits. But like so many other advances in technology, do you trust the people who will be developing it to use it and create the applications for it in the best sense? Are they just going to be out to make money? Are they just going to be out to, what's a mild version of take over the world or control the world or something like that?
Sure.
Or are they going to be, you know, most companies are, at least in America, relatively amoral. They're happy to be moral, but all they really care about is the bottom line. So as companies go through the process of the next 18 years of doubling the technological advance, their primary motive isn't going to be to make the primary motive is going to be the bottom line, and if it can be done by helping the people who are paralyzed to walk again, I'm sure they will. But that won't supersede the primary goal for everybody who works there to drive Mercedes.
Speaking of Mercedes and cash, I loved this stat from early on in the book. He was talking about, he's been around a little longer than I have, so he was using computers prior to the Apple IIe. In the Commodore 64, but he notes in 1968, he was using he wasn't using it, but you could rent time with the IBM 360 Model 91, and this computer...
I first used a computer in 71.
So this was several years prior to this.
Georgia Tech Georgia Institute of Technology.
Okay, this computer, we'll talk about yours here in a second, but this computer he's talking about in 1968, it had 1 meg of memory. It cost $1,000 an hour to rent. This is in 1968. And you think about your iPhone today, which is so much more powerful than this.
Wait, it's costing me $1,000 an hour to use to.
Oh my God, Steve, you've got the wrong plan. Tell me about the computer you were using.
In seventh grade, they took some of the brighter students, or the nerdier students, really is a better way of looking at it, at our elementary school, and took us down to Georgia Tech for a day to see this great new advance, and it was a whole row of computers. And by a whole row, I mean like four of them, and then a mainframe inside. And they had on there a program that you could run, which was alternately called King or Hammurabi, and it was a game, and it was an all-text game, and it was you were trying to become king of this Middle Eastern empire by increasing the amount of happiness in your kingdom through agricultural means. And it was unbelievably fascinating because until
the day I walked for a, door for there, a 1970 computer game, by the way.
Yeah, until I walked in the door there, I didn't even know such a computer game and such sorts of things existed. I mean, it was completely, and this was early 71. This may have even been late December 1970. And it was, my mom dropped me off, and I stayed there for 6 hours, and I was supposed to be gone in an hour and a half, and I don't think I've stopped sitting in front of a computer since. It was slow. Everything had to be, anytime there was a bug, it had to be reprogrammed with these punch cards. You take the punch cards in there, and you'd run the test, and forever it would kick a card out, like card number 211. You'd have to go figure out what that was wrong. And if you could see the programming language today, you would laugh and you'd say, a 3-year-old wrote that.
Do you remember Zork?
I do remember Zork.
I played that game, believe it or not. Some people are going to be amazed to hear this, but not only did I play Zork, but I learned BASIC, and I used to try to create my own Zork games.
How did you do?
Poorly. But the idea was it was an all-text game.
Yeah. That's the trouble about being a game programmer and stuff, is you never surprise yourself because you're creating the outcomes.
Yeah, it was an all-text game, and it was like those old choose-your-own-adventure books where it would give you the text of where you were at, and then you would... I can't even remember. It was like, go right, and then you'd type that in, and it would tell you what happened when you went right, and it's just kind of amazing.
Oh, yeah, and then right after that came the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, and you had to put the babblefish in the ear and take the towel and et cetera, et cetera, and then as soon as you did, you get back on the ship and hear the Vogon poetry and all that.
I just look at stuff like that was actually within my lifetime, and I was, like, old enough to actually be trying to create my own. And then I look at, like, you know, our own website, for example. If you look at, like, the Wrestling Observer website, and you look back at the early, not only the original Observer website, but then you look back at the F4WOnline.com website from 2005, and I think of, you know, Tony and I worked on that for a long time to get that website going, and... Meanwhile, the Brian Alvarez website, I swear to God, we started that project at like 4 o'clock p.m. and it was done by 6. I mean, it's exponential because we already have stuff in place and we're building stuff on top of stuff, and we've got all of this knowledge we've already learned, and technology is advanced. And quite frankly, we have not upgraded the website software for the Observer site yet. But the software that we're using for the Brian Alvarez site is actually the advanced version, and there's so many features on there that we can't even do on the old website that we're waiting to. We still have to figure out. There's a lot of different things, obviously, that go into the Observer website. So we have to get all the ducks in a row before we can upgrade that software. But just amazing,
endless links.
Yeah, it's just amazing that like the new version of the same software is so much more advanced than the version that we upgraded like a year ago.
Well, you know, in 18 months it'll program itself.
Oh yeah, it's going to be ridiculous. You'll enter
four or five things about how you want it to look, and suddenly it'll pop up.
I want to talk about this before we wrap it
up. By the way,
is
this the After Dark website?
Yes.
Yes. Branding is a key word, Brian.
The BrianAlvarez.com website.
Yes.
Now, I wanted to make sure we talked about this before we have to wrap it up. And this show went by way too quickly. We're going to have to do another one at some point very soon. But
We can't. And we should, because the next time I will come in, you know, we decided this basically within 48 hours.
Sure.
And give me a couple of weeks, and we can exponentially double the intelligence of my comments.
Especially because I will read the entire book by then.
Well, and he's had other books because things have happened since then, and he addresses what has happened and hasn't happened in his subsequent books.
Now, the last thing I want to discuss here is something that you touched on briefly. There is part of his theory is, and this is one of the things that some people could find scary. He manages to find a positive in it, which we can talk about, but as computers get more advanced, and in late 2020s, 2029, they will be indistinguishable from biological humans in terms of intelligence. At the rate of increase here, he believes at some point there will be a super intelligent machine, which is so intelligent that it will not only surpass the most clever biological human being, but it will be capable of making itself better, and it will repeatedly make itself better and ultimately leave biological man in the dust. Now, obviously, this would be concerning.
Then he goes on about runaway artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's a concern here, potentially.
But yeah, now go ahead, finish your thought. I just want to add that one thing. I mean, he's already seen the problem. The first problem that I would have thought of is, if it keeps growing forever, won't it just take over everything?
Yeah, now I want to get your thoughts on that. His theory as an optimist is that, don't worry, I believe that as they continue to gain in intelligence, they will ultimately be benign. Now, I want to get your thoughts on that, because I know that Michio Kaku's belief is that if we are not alone in the galaxy, we should not alert the others that are here, because...
That's correct. Stephen Hawking, very famous Stephen Hawking, agrees with that totally. He says we should fear any civilization that could actually visit us.
Because the idea is that as a species evolved, the most evolved species will be predators.
Predators, and they'll have technology, obviously, if they can go interplanetary, that we can't defend against.
Now, do you believe... I mean, where do you fall? Because you could argue that as we become more... And some people would argue even this, our humanity has come out more when you look at attempts to you know... I don't know. Some people would argue that man today is more benign than he has been in the past. Others would argue vehemently against that. But where do you fall in that? And do you think that a super intelligent machine would be benign?
I think it's probably true, and somebody will surely correct me on the board or comment otherwise if not. But in the last 25 years, there have probably been fewer wars amongst the advanced world, the developed world, than at any time since the printing press was developed. I mean, it has been, in my lifetime, it has been noticeably peaceful. I mean, even the wars we have now, what they call wars with Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, I lived through Vietnam. That was a war where, you know, 58,000 people died. This is a completely different level of combat stuff. There is just not that sort of war. What there is, and you can argue that this is not necessarily a good thing, but there's been a lot more selfishness and a lot more emphasis that we don't want any military superiority over someone else. We want economic superiority over someone else. And so we're making the life goal of everybody in our country, and this is not just the U.S., this is the developed world, we're making the life goal of our country that, to go back to the old phrase, that we want to be the country that he has, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins.
Sure.
And so there's less wars because people are focusing on their nationalism and patriotism as an expression of economic might rather than military might. And it's hard to argue that man isn't becoming more humane when so much of disease, so much money, so much time, and so much success has had in either eradicating or lessening diseases. I mean, my dad, who just recently passed away about 2 years ago, had a bad heart his whole life. In fact, his father died of a heart attack when my dad was 13, but my dad lived to 87. And as a doctor, he followed the research, and he would sometimes say at the Thanksgiving table and other things, he says, you know, if my dad were still, had his heart attack today, he would have lived as long as I have, because modern medicine has improved that much. I mean, that's humane.
Sure.
So you can argue that, you know, there's been a lot of good things and there's been a lot of waste, but I see, I'm sorry about that, somebody is carrying another person out of the office building. I'm not quite sure why that is.
What?
They're carrying them like you would carry a bride over a doorstop.
Do they appear to be?
No, don't know. No, it appears to be more of a jokey thing or a dare thing than a injury thing.
Well, that's good.
I think that the advancement of technology on the whole is highly beneficial, and I think that it is arguable that whether or not it is actually a true thing, that the advancement in all of modern intelligence is, the advancement is as double every 18 months. I'm not quite sure if that is more a general statement than a provable statement, just to so he can make the points he's going to make. And I think that in the end, it's probably more beneficial than not if this happens, but there are all, and as you can see by the, I can just imagine by the questions on the board, there are all sorts of things that really should be addressed and people should be careful about. And you've got to be able to find human beings that can be trusted to be leaders that will be in charge of making sure that the uses of these things are done as beneficially as possible.
The book is The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. The link is up on brianalvarez.com. You can head up there, click on that, information on how to get the book on your Kindle or a hardcover copy of it, in fact. So make sure you check that out. And next week, we're going to be joined by Christopher Galeski talking conspiracies. It's going to be a fun show. And in the next couple of weeks, we'll probably be doing some open line calls as well once people get an idea of the subjects that we cover on this program. And Steve, I want to thank you very much for doing the show, and we'll get working on that book, and sometime soon we'll come back and do this again.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. Once again, check it out, brianalvarez.com. Send me emails, brianalvarezafterdark@gmail.com. All the information is up on the website, and we'll talk to you again next week. Have a good night. Yeah.